Welcome to the Borderless Podcast, your guide to traveling, investing, and living beyond borders, where we talk about living the life that you want to live, where you want to live it.
All right, everybody, thanks for joining me on another Borderless Podcast. Of course, this is James Guzman. I think you're going to enjoy this podcast we had today. I talked to a guest that has written a whole book on how to optimize your Airbnb listing. He's also has lived all over the world traveling with the income he's made strictly. He started with just one Airbnb, just started renting out his place, and he was able to travel because of that. So thought that was interesting, a lot of information packed in there. And, you know, I hope that everybody's been enjoying the podcast. If you have any suggestions on some topics or things like that, please feel free to send me an email at info@borderlessblog.com. And, of course, sign up for the newsletter. I did wanted to talk a little bit about something that I think is relevant to us, people that are traveling, maybe living in different countries and this type of thing. And There are three services that I think now are very helpful for people to set up that are kind of the digital nomad type or the expat type that are still U.S. citizens or want to have a presence in the U.S. Well, the first one I want to talk about was Charles Schwab. I think a lot of people know about this, but there are some that don't. And once you go overseas, a lot of times you'll get ATM fees that will that'll really start adding up. And so Charles Schwab is the only one that I know of that will also actually reimburse you for the ATM fees that you get overseas and all that type of stuff. So you will not have to pay any of those ATM fees. So that's helpful. So having, if you're traveling around, definitely a Charles Schwab account is a good idea. A lot of people have been talking. A lot of people I know are using it. I haven't used it yet, but there's another service, Google Fi, and this is the Project Fi. This is a new service from Google, and it's actually like a cell phone service through Google where you can get a U.S. phone number, and that'll give you data plans. So 4G everywhere, all over the world, with the same plan and at the same rates. And I think you can get up to 6 gigs, and it's capped out there. So it's the most you pay is $80 a month. The least you pay is, I think, 20. So it depends on how much you use. The most you can use is 6 gigs, and that goes all over the world. Your number also goes with you all over the world, and you can get up to 3 separate cards that all go on the same account. So you can have a computer and your iPad and an iPhone or whatever type of phone you use, all coming off of that same account for the data plan. So, you know, that's very helpful, especially to have a phone number because, you know, a lot of stuff today is tied to your phone number, whether it's your banking or your business and other type of stuff. And so it's really a pain to be changing your cell phone service, changing your number all the time. So that's a good option for that. And then if you pair those two things with a traveling mailbox service. Now, there's a lot of traveling mailbox services, but virtual office, or you can use that personally. So what happens is you'll have a home address somewhere, hopefully in a low tax state in the U.S., and you can receive packages, you can receive mail. They will scan it. They'll let you know when something arrives, and they will send it to your email. And then you can decide, what you want to do with it, or they can ship to it wherever you are. And it's actual address, not a P.O. box. That's with these three things, you can have your phone service set up, mailbox set up, have your bank account with Charles Schwab. These are just, there are many different services, but I think those are pretty good, basic starting blocks that people need to think about doing if you want to travel and there's a nomad type thing. So I just wanted to, put that out there as kind of some tips. It's surprising a lot of people don't know about some of the basic stuff. So I hope that helps. And today we're talking about making money on Airbnb and traveling. So I hope that you enjoy the podcast. And here we go. Borderless. All right, everybody, and welcome to another Borderless podcast. This is your host, James Guzman, and I'm currently hanging out here in Medellin, Colombia. And today I have on the line Jasper Rivers, and he's a former equity arbitrage trader who has been living a location-independent lifestyle since 2010. He supports this lifestyle by monetizing his skills and assets on several online marketplaces, such as Airbnb, Udemy, Fiverr, Upwork, Clarity. He also teaches others how they can recognize and monetize their skills on online marketplaces and achieve a lifestyle of adventure and freedom. Through his courses on Udemy, as well as through his blog, The Traveling Dutchman, Jasper is the co-author of the amazing, the Amazon best-selling book on Airbnb hosting, Get Paid for Your Pad, How to Maximize Income from Your Airbnb Listing, an Amazon bestseller. Jasper also co-hosts the only podcast on Airbnb hosting, Get Paid for Your Pad. The show covers all subjects related to Airbnb hosting, as well as the real-life experiences told by Airbnb hosts from all over the world. Jasper has a master's degree in econometrics from the University of Groningen in the Netherlands, and has worked as an equity trader for Opnever for 6 years. He has lived in several countries, including Netherlands, the UK, the US, Hong Kong, Belgium, Brazil. And he is a fellow traveler. We have lots of people that we know in common. And he does other things other than Airbnb, but we're going to talk about traveling and making money online and all that type of stuff. And so thanks for joining me today, Jasper.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Where did you find that bio? That was really long.
Right. I saw several of them. I can't remember where I got this one specifically, but you got a lot of stuff out there. You know, your book, Get Paid for Your Pad, I mean, that's done pretty well. I think some people that have looked into Airbnb stuff have ran across that book. You're pretty early to the game. There's all kinds of people giving out, you know, advice on that. So maybe tell about that. How long have you been renting out, making money on Airbnb that has allowed you to have this location-independent lifestyle?
I started in 2012, summer of 2012, when Airbnb wasn't so well known. And at that time, there wasn't very much information about Airbnb either. Right. And so I kind of had to, you know, figure things out by myself. And I took a lot of notes from experimenting and, you know, trying different things. And those notes formed the basis of the book that I later wrote.
Right. And then the podcast, right?
Yeah, and then so when I launched the book, I thought it would be fun to do a podcast as a way to promote the book. But then the podcast became a unit on its own. And I was really enjoying doing the podcasts. And so, you know, it's been fun. I've been doing the podcast for about almost 4 years now as well. But right now there's actually like I must have written that bio a while ago, because now there's like 4 or 5 podcasts about Airbnb.
Oh yeah.
So I'm actually shifting a little bit towards not just advising people on how to rent out, you know, how to create a good listing and how to do the photos and the hospitality, the communication, all that kind of stuff. I'm going to focus more on the investment side. So how do you find a good property that will do well on Airbnb?
Yeah, no, I love that. And we're definitely going to talk about that. And I know that, you know, you, the Traveling Dutchman, I mean, you go and travel around, kind of the digital nomad type thing. I don't know if you like to call yourself that, but so, you know, that's very interesting. I've noticed that in the circles, as you get around these, you know, these hubs of the entrepreneurs that are location independent, almost everybody is in the Airbnb thing. They have, if you just mention it, they say, oh, yeah, I got a rental here and a rental there and a rental there. So, yeah. I mean, what that tells me is, you know, there's an opportunity here. I think that a lot of young people, especially, you know, they recognize a lot of the old assets that people were in, kind of the traditional assets, the stocks, and sending their money to Wall Street or the government bonds or whatever. They want to have more control of their assets, and I think that, you know, this the market, like the vacation rental market, there's an arbitrage opportunity that a lot of people, you know, haven't. You know, a lot of people are picking up on it, but there's still a lot of room there, especially in the international space. And I think that'll be there for a while, especially if you know how to present your, you know, how to, like you've written your book about how to do it correctly. You know, a lot of people just throw some stuff up there and, you know, that's, you're not maximizing your return. And so, yeah, I think this is an asset class that allows people to have get much higher profits than they would from traditional investments, and also just kind of have more control of the asset. And you can live there if you want. You know, a lot of people, they live there some of the time and rent it out the other time. So it's very versatile and it's a really cool market. And so that's why I talk about it a lot. So that was really great to find you. And What I mean, now, do you manage a lot of places like remotely, or how do you go about doing that?
Right. So basically what happened was I just had one apartment in Amsterdam, right? And this was actually funny because now one of the reasons I wrote the book is because as I was traveling, people would always ask me, what do you do for a living? And I would say, well, I rent out my apartment in Amsterdam. And they would be like, oh, okay, how many apartments do you have? I'd be like, one. And they'd be like, wait, you can live off one apartment? I was like, yeah, I mean, if you put it on Airbnb, it actually makes like a full-time income. And so I started realizing that people weren't aware of the upside of the opportunity that exists on the platform, right? Because if you have like one apartment and you're renting it out long-term, you know, you're probably never going to make enough to support yourself because the return is just so much lower, right? But to go back on what you said before, you know, the fact that a lot of people in the digital nomad space are using Airbnb, you know, to me makes a lot of sense. And I just want to comment on it because, you know, the reason I sold out Airbnb was out of necessity, more or less, you know, because I was renting out my apartment long term in Amsterdam. And well, for one, I wasn't making a very good return on it, not enough to travel. And for two, I could never stay at my own place. So when I was in Amsterdam, I could never stay there, right? Somebody else was living there. And then the third issue that I had with this model is that I wasn't sure if I could ever move back into my own apartment. You know, especially in Holland, they have very strict renter protection laws. So it's, you know, if somebody doesn't want to leave, then, you know, you're going to have to go to court, and like it's a lot of hassle. So those are the three issues that I had, and I'd never heard of Airbnb. I didn't know there was a different solution, but I wasn't happy about the situation. And I asked around. I was like, you know, what should I do with my house? Should I sell it? And then somebody mentioned Airbnb to me. And so I tried it out as a traveler, and then quickly I realized the potential. I started doing it with my apartment in Amsterdam. So I've been rambling for a bit, but what was your question again?
I mean, I don't know really how I had a question. I mean, I was asking, you know, hold on, we're gonna have to edit that. I don't know what my freaking question was.
I know you were talking about, I know your question now. Okay. So your question was, you know, how many properties do I have right now? How do I manage them? So what happened was in 2017, Airbnb became very difficult in Amsterdam because the city cooperated with Airbnb to only allow people to rent out for 60 days a year. And Airbnb was cooperating in the sense that they would block your calendar after 60 days. So, you know, and at that point I decided, okay, you know what? I'm gonna sell this house. I'm gonna buy properties in other places around the world where I can, you know, rent out short term without having any issues. I don't want to do it in a place where, you know, where there's regulations against it. Because technically I was doing it illegally for 5 years. You know, I mean back in 2012 when I started, nobody had even heard of Airbnb. So. You know, no one was concerned about what the rules were, but looking back, it turned out there was some rule that said you can't, you know, do short lettings like under 30 days or something. But anyway, so I sold the house, and instead I bought three properties so far. I still have some money in the bank to go out and buy something else. But I bought a property in Cali in Colombia, which is being furnished as we speak. I've bought something in the Philippines near Boracay, which is also as planned. It will be finished like within like 2 months. And then I bought a property in Thailand, a studio in a condominium. And that one is pre-construction. So that one won't be finished until like the end of 2019. So to answer your question, right now I'm not actually managing anything. Mm-hmm. I'll go to Cali in a couple of weeks when my apartment's ready, and I'll set things up, and I'll be back in the Airbnb game.
Right, but I mean you have in the past, right? And I mean that's what your book was about, and all that.
Yeah, exactly. I rented out my apartment in Amsterdam for 5 years on Airbnb, pretty much full time. Right. Yeah. Plus I've, you know, in the last like 3-4 years, I've consulted on, you know, many other people who are doing Airbnb, helping them with the listings and all that kind of stuff.
Right. Yeah. And what type of return are you expecting on these investments? Since now you know the market and you know what you're getting into, you're familiar with finance. So now that you've bought these places, what type of return are you thinking about getting?
Well, I'm aiming for a minimum of 8% and preferably like 10 to 12%. Mm-hmm. And that's net, right? After costs.
Right. Yeah, because this is one thing, you know. I've talked to people about, you know, long-term rentals in the United States. I know a lot of people that do that. I think that's an interesting model. The international thing, you know, it's cool for a lot of the international types that like to live internationally. They think about this. Oh, what if I buy a place here and buy a place there? You know, there are completely different types of investments that have different types of returns. You know, the thing with the international deal is that, you know, you get no leverage. So, you know, I know that you've been looking a lot into like international investments as far as rentals go. And that's what you're doing now. What about that? I mean, what about people that say, you know, why would I want to get a rental internationally? Because there's no leverage that I can put into that.
Mm. Oh, yeah, that's absolutely right. And so, you know, I think the international model works for those who have, first of all, who have cash to invest. Mm. And like you said, I think it's for people who either want to diversify, right? If you want to buy properties in multiple countries, because obviously the property market in one country can do much better than in another country. So let's say if you want to buy like 10 houses, maybe you don't want to buy all of them in the U.S. Maybe you want to say, hey, I'm going to buy 5 in the U.S. and I'll buy one in Mexico, or buy one in Argentina, buy one in Europe and one in Asia or something, right? That way you're diversified, the currency, you're also in terms of currency, you're diversified. So that could be a reason. But yeah, for sure. I mean, to be honest with you, like I don't really recommend everybody to go out there and buy a property in some foreign country, because it's actually, I think it's actually quite risky. I've come across a lot of people who've been scammed, a lot of people who've, you know, ended up paying like a much higher price than they should have. I think, you know, before you buy a property, you need to understand the culture. You need to know the country. You need to know the market where you're buying. So if you're somebody who's, for example, living in the U.S. and, you know, you've never been outside of the U.S., I mean, the last thing I would recommend is that you go to some foreign country and just buy something, right? You really want to take your time. And so if you're looking to invest and you don't really want to travel a lot and you haven't been to a lot of countries, I would actually recommend start in your own neighborhood. You know, buy something where you know the market. So I'm not necessarily saying that people should go international. And like you said as well, like if you buy within the U.S., for at least for U.S. citizens, I'm not a U.S. citizen, but for U.S. citizens, they can get a mortgage, they can leverage. Yeah. And so that can really jack up the rate of returns.
Yeah, I mean, as long as that lasts, like, right? I mean, we don't know how long these low interest rates in the U.S. are going to last. Mm-hmm. You know, this subsidized 30-year fixed is it's great for while it lasts, I guess, you know, if people can take advantage of that. But, you know, that's not going to allow you to go internationally. And, I think that as far as international real estate, you know, it gives you some other, you know, you have some other angles at it. Depending, you know, if you want to get another citizenship, you can buy some property. And if you rent it out or have it, you know, different ways, then that can help you get a citizenship or residency. Mm-hmm. Kind of with the five flag theory type thing, where if you have, you know, that can then be a residence for you and in a different country for a variety of reasons. It can also be kind of like a bug out pad, you know, say that you live and everything in the States, but you have someplace else that you know that you can go to if it doesn't work out in your home city, you got another place that you can always go to. So there's lots of different ways to look at it, but I would say that it is good to, I mean, I think a lot of people are attracted to this type of rental, especially internationally, because it's sexy and stuff like that. Like, you know, they just think, oh, I can have some place on the beach and, you know, in Argentina or, you know, whatever, and just skip down there, whatever I want to. And, I mean, that's cool. It is cool to think, you know, to have something like that. But mm-hmm. at the same time, you know, you got to take into consideration the numbers of it, you know. And a lot of times real estate can be just bought sight unseen. You know, it doesn't matter as long as the numbers work. But, you know, when you're just starting out, for sure, you know, something you're familiar with the market, and the prices there and all that type of stuff. You know, that's why, you know, when people come down to San Miguel de Allende, I'm not there at the moment, but, you know, I kind of help people get acclimated there. I introduce them to the right people and stuff. And, you know, I've been in Mexico, I spent, you know, about 8 years there. So, you know, I'm pretty, I know the market pretty well. I've, you know, worked with big real estate firms, you know, like Coldwell Banker and things like that. So, you know, it could just really skip through a lot of headache if you know somebody there, somebody that's familiar with the market and stuff like that. But,
yeah.
You know, another thing that I would say about kind of international real estate seems to me is that it's a more imperfect market, you know, meaning that, you know, they don't have the same MLS and Zillow and all this type of stuff that they have in the U.S. and other, you know, Western countries and developed countries. Mm-hmm. A lot of you know, stuff that people are right on it. If there's any sort of a deal, if there's any sort of, you know, something like that, people are really on it. And in less developed countries, you can actually hit the ground, get to know people, talk to local agents, talk to just locals, read signs, go to Craigslist, just to, whatever. And you can find better deals that way. You know, people that are in distress for whatever reason, they just want to get rid of it. Maybe people that haven't even looked at it for 10 years. If you're willing to do a little bit of work on the property, you can get some pretty good deals. So, you know, that's another angle.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I'm actually writing a book on this topic. I'm kind of writing down my experiences and the lessons that I've learned from, you know, from going around the world, finding places to invest in, and also I'm doing the case studies of my investments as well as 10 other people who've invested abroad, not only abroad, also in the US. You know, what I've noticed is that, just like you're saying, is that the people who are seeing like really good success with their foreign investments are people that really know that area very well, right? So, for example, you're living somewhere for a few years, and then, you know a lot of people, you ask around, just like you said, and you can find a deal that some tourist who just, you know, comes by for like a couple of weeks to try and find something to buy, that person is never going to find that deal, right? So I think what you're saying is absolutely true.
Yeah. All right. Well, I did want to, like, since this is what you've written your book about, this is what you do podcasts, I thought maybe we'd dig in to some of the, like, nuts and bolts of this stuff. You know, I'm sure a lot of people are thinking about, you know, well, let's just say insurance, right? Like, what are the liability risks and all this type of stuff? So how do you handle that specifically with insurance on your Airbnb rentals?
Yeah, that's actually a good point, because a lot of homeowner insurances don't cover Airbnb, and so if something happens to your guest, your homeowner's insurance might not cover it, because it's considered a business. And your homeowner's, you know, policy is not a business policy, so that's definitely something you have to be very careful with. In the property that I bought in Colombia, it's actually, the whole building is actually insured. The people that developed the building, they actually took care of that. So there is a short term renting insurance on the property. So, you know, this is something that everybody has to check. You know, not just people who invest abroad. I'm pretty sure there's tons of Airbnb hosts all around the world who think that they have insurance, but who actually don't. So I've actually written a blog post about liability insurance a while ago on getpaidforyourpet.com on my blog, because it's, you know, it's one of those things. It's the chance is very small that something will happen, but if something does happen, you could be liable for quite a lot of money. So,
yeah, Yeah, I think this is even more of an issue for people in the States, because, you know, it's like in Latin America, maybe, you know, it's not somebody slips and falls, they're not going to really come after you. But, you know, states, especially, you know, in certain states in the United States, then they could really do that. You know, I see that you recommend all kinds of different I don't know what you do, you know, services and things that surround this. I mean, what are kind of the top online kind of services that supplement or work along with Airbnb that you recommend to people that are getting started at Airbnb?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's over 100 tools at this point. I remember when I wrote the book, I remember there was not a single tool out there yet. But I think the most important ones, the first one I'd say people should use is the pricing apps, because, you know, that can really increase your income quite a bit, because it's just so difficult to calculate the prices and also to update them every day, yeah. Right? And so to have a company with data analysts and algorithms and, you know, lots of data to calculate all that stuff for you and update your calendar like on a daily basis, which also helps to rank your listing higher in the search results. For me, it's like a no-brainer. It typically costs like 1% of your revenue. And I mean, my guess is, I mean, most of these companies, they're saying that your revenue could increase up to 40%. Now that may not always be the case, but I'm pretty confident that it will, in most cases, it will increase at least like 5, 10 or 15% or so. And so, you know, that 1%, you make it back pretty quickly. I mean, the one that I've always used is Beyond Pricing, but there's a few other ones. And
yeah, I mean, there's Wheelhouse.
Yeah, there's Wheelhouse. There's Price Labs. There's there's a few other ones out there. And these days, a lot of the management software that's out there is they have their own price optimization sometimes too. But yeah, so that's the pricing, and then the second one that I would always use, if you only have one listing, if you have multiple listings, you're probably going to use some sort of management software like AirGMS or so, and that includes automated messaging. But if you don't, then I really recommend SmartBnB or Aviva IQ, and those are platforms that you can use to send automated messages, because that's another part that's very important to keep your response rate and your response time very sharp. And so if you're sleeping, let's say you sleep for 8 hours, potentially you could get a message right after you fall asleep. And then when you wake up 8 hours later, then your response time is like 8 hours, which isn't good. It should always be less than an hour. And so if you use automated messaging, then, you know, an automated message will be sent out saying like, hey, I'll get back to you as soon as possible. Thank you for your inquiry or something like that. So that's the second one that I think, you know, it's almost like a no-brainer. Especially because a lot of these messaging apps, they can do smart messaging as well. You can do scheduled messaging, so you can schedule the check-in, the check-out, the messages that you want to send after people have checked out, thank you message, asking for reviews, all that kind of stuff. You can all automate it. And some of these, I know SmartBnB can even recognize questions that people ask. So if somebody asks a question and there's the word Wi-Fi in it, you could actually automatically send them Wi-Fi instructions and stuff like that. So,
yeah, can it do it in different languages? That's the thing.
SmartBnB actually has a multilingual feature, which I think is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then I'd say the third thing that I've always used is the guidebooks, right? I mean, when I started, there was no apps around. I created a 25-page printed guidebook, right, which served its purpose, and I would email it as a PDF, but it's pretty big, and it's not optimal. And so when these online guidebook applications came around, so Hostly is the one that I've always been using. Basically, what you do is you just create an online version of your guidebook, and then you just send the link to your guests so that they can easily, on their smartphone, their tablet, they can just look it up at any time. They don't have to carry around like a printed thing, although they can print it out if they want to. But anyway, like, so those are the three that I would use. And then, you know, there's tons of other ones out there. I mean, if you look at my blog, I've got a whole overview. It's a pretty long page It's you can find it on the front page. You can see Airbnb tools and resources. There you can find like an overview of all the different ones that are out there. I mean, there's so much out there now.
Right.
You know, there's apps like Noise Aware, for example, that you can use to monitor the noise levels in your house. And so when right. the noise level is too high, you can actually message your guest and say like, hey, can you
shut the hell up?
Yeah, can you like turn it down, turn the music down or whatever? Because right. I don't want to get complaints from the neighbors or even worse, like get police involvement.
Yeah.
You know, there's a tablet that you can provide and use to sell extra services to your guests. Yeah. You know, it's called You're Welcome.
You're Welcome, yeah.
So, you know, there's a ton of stuff out there.
Right.
A ton of stuff out there. But those are basically the free that I think is almost like a no-brainer for anyone. Like, I wouldn't know why you wouldn't want to use a pricing app, a messaging app, and a guidebook app.
Right. Yeah, I had Hostfully for a while. They just got bought out by Orbi Rental. So that's the same company now.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's right. Cool. I mean, yeah, see, that's the type of things. Like, if you just have little, professional details there, then that can, you know, save you a lot of work. And also, you know, you get more rentals. You have great, returning guests and stuff like that. I noticed on your website, you also recommend people set up their own website.
Yeah,
I mean, anymore? I don't know. I saw you had a blog post about that. I set up my website, and I just wanted to know, you know. I don't know that I necessarily recommend that, but I did do that, and I was wondering what your view is on that.
Well, it's not something that I would say is a must. I think it's optional. I think it serves a purpose. I think it's good for branding. And so, if for example, if you if you're at a party or something, and somebody's like, "Hey, I'm going to stay at your places are in San Miguel de Allende," which actually I was there a couple of days ago, coincidentally. If someone's like, "Hey, where do I find your listings?" and you go like, "Oh, it's like Airbnb.com/room/2360201," you know, if you say like, "Oh, it's Guzman's." Guzmanspets.com or whatever, you know, it's like an online business card.
Right.
Although I have to say that now Airbnb is introducing custom domains.
Custom domains, yeah.
Right. So I guess they. It's funny because if you see the development of Airbnb and the innovation that they do, it's often based off a third party app, right? I mean, first you had the pricing apps, and then Airbnb looks at that and say, "Hey, okay, I guess we should do that." And so
they're not doing such a good job of it, right? I mean,
well, that's the thing; it's not their core business, right? So it's their core business is the Airbnb website, right? I mean, their core business isn't calculating prices, and also they're not very good advisors because they they're wearing two hats. Right, they have to look after the guests and the hosts, and so, and so I think a lot of these things that a lot of these apps that Airbnb is trying to replace, I don't necessarily think they're going to do a very good job of all of them because they're just not specialized in it, but they could do a good job, and they also just buy out some of these companies sometimes, which can help. But going back to the point of having your own website, another argument for having your own website is that you can be independent.
Right.
I just had somebody in my Airbnb group who got their Airbnb listing deactivated, and for no apparent reason.
Wow.
And that's not the first time that happens quite a bit, and it's Airbnb always has the right to close your account without giving you any reasons as to why. That's the right that they reserve.
Shit.
And so, it doesn't happen. I mean, it's still a small percentage of the host, obviously, that it happens to, but still, like, when it does happen to you, and you've already running like 30% of your bookings for your own website or something, then obviously that's an advantage. Yeah. So I'd say, those are the branding and, being independent, not being dependent on a third-party website are the two arguments. Also, there's one more argument. There's, obviously if somebody books for your own website, then they don't have to pay that 12% guest service fee. So it's a little cheaper as well. And well, depending on your payment system, you might still end up paying the 3% for the credit card. But
yeah, that's what I noticed, is because on my website, you know, I'm using Stripe, and so really, I'm not even saving money because it's only 3% on Airbnb. That just occurred to me later on. I was like, wow, that's really cheap. What, you know, the service that Airbnb offers, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they're really making money on that. That 3% is just what they pay the credit card companies, no? So, but it's the 12% that the guest saves, yeah. Right? So you can be a little bit more competitive in your pricing.
Okay. Well, that's cool. So, you know, we didn't even talk about it before the thing, but on a whole other note. So how did you like San Miguel? Did you have a good time there?
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. I loved it. It was such a very picturesque, like very – very cute little city. I love that it's very hilly, right? So you've got the nice views and stuff. Yeah. Very, very quiet. I noticed there's a lot of foreigners there.
Yeah, well, so the thing is that there, during the week, especially, I think, like, you went on a very slow week. And so that's the time when a lot of the people that are out, meaning out at the restaurants, out at the places, those are, like, the retired foreigners that are there. I mean, they're the ones that have money to go out on a slow weekend right after Semana Santa and go be at a restaurant or a bar or something. But when you go on, like, the week before that, which was Semana Santa, it's like full of Mexican people and locals and stuff. But yeah, during the slow weeks, that's when, so it's like kind of interesting. That's what the businesses have to do, is kind of straddle that, because when it's low, they can always cater to the people with the U.S. pensions and Social Security coming in and stuff. And then on the weekends, they have to cater to the Mexican market, because they come in and they spend a lot of money, man. You know, and so anyways, that's why the city's kind of cool, is that on certain weekends, it can be like a big city party feel. And then other times, it's a small town feel. So glad you had a good time out there. You're there for a wedding or something, right?
Yeah, the wedding was like an hour away in a place called Querétaro.
Yeah. Okay.
Querétaro. Yeah. But then, we just went for a couple of days just to check it out.
Right. So, I mean, you are the traveling Dutchman. You know what I mean? You're renting out these places and hanging out all over the world. Now you're back in DFA. You're in San Miguel, and you got a place in Cali. And what? So, I mean, what's up with that? I mean, you got some places, like some bases, or how are you planning out, like, how you're living right now? Maybe would you call yourself a digital nomad, or what would you say that you are?
Yeah, digital nomad, location independent. I last time I spent more than, let's say, 3 months in one location was back in 2010 when I was still living in Chicago. So, you know, I've been strolling around for like 8 years, and it's just become a normal to me, you know. It's become the default.
So how often do you usually go to a new place?
I don't, you know, here's the thing, like, I don't plan ahead a lot. I think the best experiences that I've had during my travels are the ones where I kind of decided a week or 2 weeks in advance to go somewhere, to do something based on the people that I met or what my friends are up to. And I feel like, you know, just kind of going with the flow is what fits me best. I've also had periods where I've planned more, where I planned out everything, and what would happen is, you know, opportunities would arise and I wouldn't be able to take advantage of them.
Right.
Because I had already planned everything out. So right now, for example, we're recording this on April 11th. And I know where I'm going to be until April 30th. I'll be in Puerto Rico April 23rd to April 30th, where I'll be speaking at a conference there about Airbnb, real estate conference, which I'm very excited about. I know you have some roots in Puerto Rico, right?
Yeah.
I'm very excited. I've never been, and it seems like a place that there's a lot of opportunities. So, but yeah, April 30th, I have a one-way ticket, so I don't know where I'm going to go. I might, if my place is ready in Colombia, I might just go to Colombia. If not, who knows? Maybe I'll stay in Puerto Rico for a couple of weeks or even longer.
Right. Well, I think a lot of people would say, wow, you know, that sounds cool, but, you know, you're young and single, and who knows? I mean, how do you do this as far as the money aspect? A lot of people are probably thinking, they say, well, how the hell do you make money when you're jumping around like that?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, the money that I make is on my laptop, right? So I can work on my laptop from anywhere in the world. Right now what I'm doing is I'm always kind of like doing different things at the same time. But right now, you know, I have the Airbnb blog. I do consultancy calls. I have video courses on Udemy, as you mentioned. You know, I get commissions when people sign up for the services that we discussed earlier. So I'm doing a little, obviously I'm selling my book on Amazon. I'm doing a little trading, and I'm trading some digital currency futures, like arbitrage trading, which I used to do in financial markets as well. And then there's the real estate, right? There's the properties. Like right now, I'm not making anything from the properties because they're not rented out yet. But soon enough, that's another source of income. So, I mean, I think these days it's becoming easier and easier to sort of work remotely. I think and make a living on your laptop. I'm not saying it's easy because it's still not easy, but at least it's more feasible than like 10 or 15 years ago. And right. So you're seeing a lot of more people doing it, right? I mean, these hubs that you were mentioning earlier where all these digital nomads conglomerate, you know, things like Chiang Mai and Ubud in Indonesia and Medellin, where you're at right now, there's quite a few of them there. They tend to, you know, pick the places where the cost of living is pretty low. There's a decent infrastructure, good Wi-Fi. I mean, there's thousands and thousands of digital nomads in these places now. I remember when I
name some of the top ones that you know of, places that.
Well, like I said, so Chiang Mai is I think one of the biggest one actually.
I haven't been there,
and it's also very notable because it's a very small town in the north of Thailand, and I think there's like, I don't know how many there are, but there's thousands of them in Chiang Mai, and yeah. You notice it because you walk on the street and you see a lot of foreigners, right? But that's a place that's not very well known. I mean, Ho Chi Minh City. I spent some time, 5 weeks in Ho Chi Minh City. There's a decent community there. Ubud in Bali is also one that a lot of people go to, and there's places like Koh Lanta in Thailand. There's, you know, a place like Tarifa in Spain, like places where you can do like kite surfing and surfing and stuff. Some of those places are pretty popular. But then also major cities like Buenos Aires is a place where quite a lot of people hang out, right? And then Medellin, where you're at right now, there's a lot of people there. Those are sort of the places that I have been to where I've seen a lot of other digital nomads, but I'm sure there's other ones.
A lot of Southeast Asia, huh? And I guess, Puerto Rico, they're trying to do Puerto Rico to that. Maybe we can talk a little bit about that. I mean, you're going to speak at this conference. It's a lot of people that are talking about Act 20 and Act 22. These are the acts that allow people to, you know, if you're a bona fide resident there, if you spend enough time there, then you don't have to, you know, pay certain taxes. And so that's attracting a lot of people, especially I think that a lot of people that are involved in crypto want to go there because there's no capital gains tax. If you take advantage of this thing. So, what do you think about Puerto Rico? What's going on there? What's up with the conference?
Yeah, so, I mean, I was invited to speak on the topic of Airbnb. So basically, the people that organize it, they think there's a lot of opportunity right now because the real estate prices are, you know, they're a lot lower than in some other places, comparable places, and the rates that people charge on Airbnb seem quite high for what you're getting, right? And so I was asked to sort of do some research and make an assessment of what the quality of the Airbnb listings are that are in Puerto Rico, specifically in San Juan. Because, you know, as you know, as an Airbnb host, you know, when you're doing long-term rental, it's pretty much about the numbers, right? If you look at what other people are making, that'll be roughly what you'll be making as well. But as an Airbnb host, you can have two identical properties. But if one person is a bad host and he's getting bad reviews, then that person isn't going to make any money. Whereas you're being a really good host, you could be making like 10-15%, right? So it's not just about the price of the real estate and the, you know, the prices that people are charging. It's also, you know, how well are you doing as a host? And so, you know, when I look at a market to invest in, it's one of the factors I look at. I look at, okay, who am I going to be competing against? You know, now you're in Medellin right now. If you go on Airbnb Medellin, you'll notice that there's a very large variety of very, very well decorated, well furnished, great looking Airbnb listings with great pictures, good descriptions, great reviews. There's a ton of them to choose from. Well, I reserved my Airbnb in Puerto Rico a few days ago, and I mean, I couldn't find very many great listings with great pictures and places that looked great. It was quite a bit of a challenge to find something good, and so, you know, I think there's a lot of opportunity for people in Puerto Rico to do Airbnb and, you know, to sort of outcompete the people who, you know, who are hosting right now. And, you know, hopefully, you know, I also want to encourage those people to improve, of course. And, you know, it's kind of what I do is kind of help people improve with their Airbnb hosting. But it seems like the market is not very competitive on Airbnb right now.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's great. You know, you got some opportunity there. I mean, it's definitely a spot that people like to vacation. So that's for sure. But yeah, I mean, I see what you mean. You know, I'm looking at Medellin right now. They got some nice looking places. And the thing is that, you know, what I've noticed is that still today, even in markets that have pretty mature, you could say like a mature Airbnb market or something, you know, there's a lot of garbage out there. You know what I mean? Like, there's still just people, the majority of people, they just, you know, it's not well decorated. The appliances don't work. They don't communicate. And, you know, if you just go there and do a halfway decent job, then you can do well, you know, in most places, it seems like to me.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, if I look at Medellin, for example, like one of the reasons that I invested in Cali and not in Medellin is because I see that a lot of people are doing a very good job in Medellin. So I'll be competing against people who are doing a very good job. Right. And so but the other thing in Puerto Rico that I was going to mention is, you know, look at the prices that they're charging. They're charging pretty steep prices for these apartments, even though it's not looking so great. So I definitely think there's some opportunity, and also because, you know, the government, obviously after the bankruptcy, after the hurricane, the government's obviously looking for, you know, a way to rebuild the country, right? And I think tourism is going to be, you know, one of the things that they're going to focus on. And so I think they're going to really try and get more people to visit Puerto Rico. So I wouldn't be surprised if the number of tourists that flock to Puerto Rico are going up as well, which is an opportunity in itself.
Yeah, I mean, as I wrote in an email to my email list a few days ago, I mean, it's hard to make the argument that the market there is not in a depressed state. You know, before this storm hit, this horrible storm that made the news, they had this the debt crisis before that they've been in for a while. So, they've had economic troubles, and then you have the hurricane, and so it's just as far as, you know, people's thinking about it, it's like that old saying, time to buy is when there's blood in the streets. When you're a contrarian, when everybody else is like, oh, no, no way, I don't want to go there, you know, that's a good time to buy if you can get in there, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And at the same time, I think the people in Puerto Rico also need some capital to come into the country to help rebuild, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's not like, you know, it's a freaking beautiful, you know, ocean in the Caribbean. I mean, it's not like it's the worst thing in the world. You know, I mean,
yeah, beautiful. No, exactly. I've never been, but I've, because I've been doing research on Airbnb, I've been looking at some pictures of the beaches and stuff, and yeah, it looks amazing.
Yeah.
So then you know, the other advantage for people like we talked about before in the U.S. I mean, this is kind of like a tropical destination, but you can't get leverage there, right? Because it's part of the United States.
Good point.
So is so it's got a lot of things going for it. I would say is. In terms of from an investment perspective, although I have to say I haven't been yet, you know, I have to actually see it. But from what I've seen so far, it seems like there's good opportunity there.
Right. All right. Well, cool. So, you know, obviously you're from the Netherlands, right? As the traveling Dutchman, this is what you. And so, at some point in time, you decided you wanted to, you know, you studied econometrics and you had this career in finance. Can you walk me through what that was? Like, what was the reason that you decided to, to leave that career and even leave the Netherlands?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, when I was younger, I wasn't quite sure what the goal of my life was, what my purpose in life was. I remember I was used to wonder about that, but I couldn't really figure it out. And so as sort of a placeholder for my purpose in life, I thought, you know what, let me just try and make a lot of money, right? Because that's kind of like what society tells you to do. And so, yeah, so I went into finance. That was the main reason I went into finance, because I knew there was money to be made. So I started in Amsterdam. I traded there for 5 years. And then I actually wanted to quit. I wanted to quit after 5 years because I started realizing that the extra money that I was making, it wasn't really changing my life in a meaningful way. It was just kind of like a number on my bank account that would change. And so I thought, okay, is this really, you know, is this a number on my bank account changing? Is that really worth me spending, you know, most of my time in this office and not feeling like I'm not really learning anything? I'm just like kind of like, you know, doing a trick to make money in the financial markets. And so the answer to me was no. And so I actually quit, but my boss convinced me to stay and asked me, like, is there any way you could stay? And I was thinking, well, there's an office in Chicago. I was working for a Dutch company, but they had an office in Chicago. And so I said, well, you know, if I can work in Chicago, I'll stick around for a while. And so that's what happened. I moved to Chicago. I had an amazing time there. I loved the city. It was great. I made a lot of friends. I had an awesome time. But at the time, also the markets were very quiet. This is right after the financial crisis. So back in 2009, 2010, the volatility had collapsed. And so, you know, there wasn't that much opportunity at the time. And so after 1 year in Chicago, I decided, okay, now I'm going to, you know, try and figure out what I really want to do with my life instead of sitting in an office. And I didn't really have a plan, but all I knew was I just wanted to take that gamble, because I just didn't want to, you know, just grow old with the regret of not, you know, never having tried something different, something that I felt like I really wanted to do. And traveling was the one thing that I, you know, always wanted to do. I've always had a curiosity about like other countries and cultures and languages. And so I wanted to take a shot at it. And well, there I am. It's 8 years ago. So,
but how did that, I mean, we can go through kind of the specifics of that. I mean, you say you just went a shot at it. I mean, how did you do that? Just by renting your apartment or what?
Yeah. So I was fortunate. Fortunately, I didn't blew the money that I made. I paid off my mortgage with the money that I earned during my years in finance, and so I had an apartment that was mortgage free. And so I was renting it out long term for the first 2 years of my travels. And like we talked about before, I realized that wasn't gonna be enough for me to support myself, and I didn't have that much savings to like just not do anything for the rest of my life, right? So I had to at some point find some sort of source of income. And so, you know, I tried lots of things, to be honest with you. I remember the first couple months I was just Googling. I was just trying to find ways to make money in
Google. How to make money.
Yeah, no, I mean, seriously, like, I mean, I'd never done anything else than trading, right? I didn't know anything about the internet, websites, or whatsoever. So I literally Googled exactly what you just said. And, you know, as you can imagine, the things that I found were, you know, not the most like value-added sustainable types of businesses that you really want to engage yourself in. But at the same time, I tried a bunch of things and, you know, made a little bit of money here and there. But in the process, I learned a lot of lessons. I learned some SEO. I learned a little bit about how websites work, how marketing, online marketing. And, you know, I'm obviously still learning. I still don't really consider myself an expert in that. But you know, at least I have enough of an understanding now to be able to, you know, run a profitable blog. But I mean, that took a while. I mean, the first couple of years, it was, you know, it was not smooth sailing. Let's put it that way.
Right.
But every time I tried something, I learned something, and I tried to do a better job next time. And you know, eventually, I guess I found the topic of Airbnb. That's something that I was passionate about. It was something that was new. It was a hot topic. Not a lot of people were writing about it. And so, you know, that kind of. But if I hadn't done all those other things, like I wrote a book about traveling, for example, as well, that Amazon didn't want to publish because they said it wasn't good enough, right? So, but if I hadn't written that book, then my second book, my Get Paid for Your Pet book, wouldn't have been the success that it was. And so, you know, that's kind of like the road. That was kind of like my road, just a lot of bumps and a lot of ups and downs and a lot of things that didn't work. And then eventually it kind of converged into something, you know, eventually you kind of find your path.
Yeah. So it sounds like for you, there wasn't anything, there wasn't like a big break or, you know, some specific thing that allowed you to go location independent. You know, you just started renting out your place and you're making a little bit amount of money that just allows you to get by. And then you have multiple streams of online income that allowed you to kind of continue that.
I mean, it was somewhat of an easy, like, quote unquote, easy start. Because I had my apartment with no mortgage. I mean, I know people who took this path with like $10,000, $5,000 of savings, which I think is very courageous. But at the same time, I was also sacrificing a pretty, you know, a lot of security, right? I mean, that finance job that I was doing, I mean, you know, that was a job that I was very happy with, other than spending time in the office, which I didn't like. But I mean, I was quite fortunate that I was able to have that job, you know, because it was paying really well. And so if I stayed for another 5 years or so, I could have made maybe enough money to, you know, to be financially secure for the rest of my life. And so I kind of, you know, even though I had the house without the mortgage, which is a nice backup, also the opportunity that I sort of gave up on was quite substantial as well. So that was the sort of the harder part for me to make the decision, is to know that I was going to do something that I had no idea where it was going to go. I had no idea if I was ever going to make any money. I was thinking when I left, I was thinking that I'll probably end up back working in finance after like a year or two, or, you know, whenever my money would run out, or. And so I definitely wasn't expecting me to be still traveling after 8 years.
Right. Oh, well, that's cool. I mean, you pulled it off, right? So here you are. And no, I mean, it's and so I'm sure that you know, other, you are happy that you did that, right? I mean, you're in the position now where I mean, how would you say that your life is different? I mean, you know, to what magnitude has it improved? I would say this, your days in like finance.
Oh, I mean, it's a different planet. and I'm not saying I was unhappy, you know. I mean, that wasn't the case. But I just knew that I really wanted something different. Mm-hmm. And you know, like now, what I'm doing is I feel like I'm doing what I should be doing, or doing, you know, what I always wanted to do. And so it's, you know, it's not that I wasn't happy before, but now I have, I guess I could say I have more of sort of like an inner peace, knowing that I'm, you know, I'm on my path. I know my direction. I know my northern star. And you know, that gives a lot of inner peace, just kind of feeling that you're doing what you want to do and what you're supposed to do.
Right. Nice. Yeah, no, that's great. All right, so as we wrap this up, let's talk about, you know, you got a lot of stuff going on. Your latest thing, I think, is the book that you're going to be launching. So tell us a little bit about this book.
Yeah, so, you know, when I sold my apartment in Amsterdam, I had no idea how to reinvest that money, right? I had no idea where. I had no idea what was a good place for Airbnb, what's the regulations, what's the legal system, the risks. I really didn't know much. And so all I knew was I traveled for 7 years at the time. And so I knew a bunch of places where I thought, okay, you know, this is a place where I'd like to spend some time. And I feel like there's probably going to be other people that would like to spend some time here as well. And so, you know, I had a sort of a macroeconomically, I had an idea of a couple places that I thought would be doing well in the future. And so I started visiting those. And as I was visiting and researching to see if there was opportunity, I just kind of like wrote down my experiences. And so the book I don't really see it as the first book that I wrote was more like a brain dump. It was like, okay, here's everything I learned. I know I'm doing a good job. I know I've figured a lot of things out that a lot of people aren't doing right. I could see it on the Airbnb website. I mean, you're saying right now it doesn't look that great sometimes. Well, I can tell you back in 2014, it was a lot worse than it is now. So then I really felt like, okay, I'm an expert on this topic and I'm going to help people with this book. But the second book now that I'm writing is a bit different. It's more like a learning experience for myself that I share with other people. So, you know, it's more like we're learning together because I'm not really an expert on the topic. And that's also why I've included 10 case studies of other people who've invested abroad successfully and unsuccessfully as well. Because, you know, you can learn a lot from other people's experiences, right? And so it's, I guess so that's kind of the difference between the first book and the second book. But still, I think this book is going to be really interesting because there's not much out there on this particular topic.
Right.
You know, there's not a book that specifically talks about short-term rental investments, you know, especially overseas. I couldn't find very much. But, you know, on the topic of Airbnb, there's probably like 50 or maybe like 100 books right now.
Yeah. You know, I did want to ask you, so out of all the things that you mentioned, you have these multiple streams of income. What would you say is like right now? Because these are, I feel like these are all changing all the time. Which one is better and which one's worse? So right now, which one is better? And the reason I ask is, you know, if somebody's just starting and they say, well, what should I concentrate my efforts on? What would you say?
Well, the thing is, like right now for me, I'm trading futures, like cryptocurrency futures, which is going pretty well. But I wouldn't necessarily recommend that to other people because that's, you know, I just happen to have an expertise in that, right? I traded for 6 years in the financial markets. And so, you know, for me particularly, that's doing pretty well. The you know, the get paid for your pad is kind of like the stable thing that's always generating kind of like a stable, the book and the blog, the podcast, it's always kind of like stable.
Well, that's what I mean, you know. Like specifically out of like affiliate marketing or a book or what would you say?
I mean, for me, for as far as get paid for your pet, the commissions on when people sign up for products, that's why I'd love to encourage everybody to, you know, go to the tools page that I have, because if you sign up, you get like a good deal, and then I get like some referral fee as well, right?
So affiliate marketing.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, but that's what's doing really well for me right now. It's just because, like you said, there's so many tools out there now, right? But a couple of years ago, that wasn't the case at all. Then it was more like the, you know, the book sales that was the major part of the income. And I was, you know, doing consults, you know, telephone consults, for example.
Right.
But if I were to give advice to people, if somebody's listening and saying, hey, you know what, I'm not really happy at my job. I want to try something new. I want to take like a year or 2 years and go live in Ho Chi Minh City or Medellin and not spend a lot of money and try to work on a business. I mean, I can only speak, of course, from my experience as a, like my website, it's what they call like a niche authority website. it's not easy, I think, to make a lot of money with it. It takes a lot of time. But here's the advice that I would give for people who have some topic in mind. I would say, like, start with something very specific. So try to really niche down, because that way it'll be much easier to get traction initially, because there's not going to be a lot of people who are talking about that very specific thing, right? So, for example, the first blog I started was The Traveling Dutchman. It was about travel. But guess what? I'm competing with all these big travel blogs that have been around for like 10 years. And so, I never managed to make significant money from that. And then when I did Airbnb, I niched down quite a bit, right? Travel and then accommodations, home sharing, Airbnb, right? And so that's what I would recommend people. Start small, start very specific, and then as you grow your audience, you can branch out to wider, more general topics.
Right. All right, great. Yeah, very good advice. All right, well, cool. Jasper, thanks so much for coming on. I think that we've had a great conversation. People can get a lot of information out of this, and look forward to your book. I'll definitely read it, so send me a link over there and send that out to my email list and all that, and good luck in Puerto Rico.
All right, man. Well, thanks for inviting me.
Okay, no problem, man. All right, well, let's keep in touch. Have a good one.
Thanks for joining us for the Borderless Podcast, traveling, investing, and living beyond borders.